This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Extreme heat and fire continue to ravage Greece. Athens does have a new heat officer for the city. She wants to redesign Athens to deal with climate change.
I'm afraid that if we don't move now, it's going to be too late. I think this is the really kind of almost the last time that we can change how to design the city and how to live in this city.
Also today, technically Russia is banned from these Olympics for wide-scale doping. It's not clear Russians in Moscow see this as punishment.
Russia is still the best in spite of everything. And the evil West is trying to punish us for being so great.
And thousands of stolen artifacts are heading back to Iraq from the U.S.
Returning them is great, but this is just sort of, you know, a little drop in a bucket.
Because the looting of cultural artifacts has not stopped. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us this Thursday. Big question, do fully vaccinated people need a coronavirus vaccine booster? Even if we do, should those of us in wealthier nations be waiting for people in much of the world to get their first jabs? The World Health Organization made their position clear yesterday. Countries need to hold off on boosters. The recommendation comes just as Pfizer and Moderna are reporting record high earnings and are facing increasing scrutiny for those profits. The World's Ilana Gordon covers global health for the show and has been digging into this. First of all, Ilana, the so-called moratorium on boosters, what's the reasoning on this?
Well, like you said, Marco, much of the world, like the majority of people, still don't have access to vaccines right now. More than 4 billion vaccine doses have gone out globally just in looking at the numbers, but 4 out of every 5 shots have been in high-income countries. Here's WHO's Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus.
We cannot and we should not accept countries that have already used most of the global supply of vaccines, using even more of it, while the world's most vulnerable people remain unprotected.
Does this recommendation from the WHO have any teeth, or is it simply guidance?
The WHO can only nudge, and actually within hours of those remarks, we heard from leaders from countries like France and Germany that they are moving forward with boosters for older adults. The U.S. is still reviewing when and whether boosters will be needed, but the government has ordered more shots. The White House yesterday stated that this doesn't have to be an either-or. The world can be vaccinated, and we can have boosters too. So that's a different take. And of course, the country's also donating hundreds of millions of vaccines.
So, Ilana, who or what body makes decisions about vaccine distribution globally?
A lot of these contracts between countries and vaccine makers, they're for the most part not public. And so it makes it hard to know both what countries are paying and who gets to be at the front of the line on these shipments with those decisions. I spoke with Andrea Taylor about this. She's an assistant program director at Duke's Global Health Institute. She says that initially countries in Europe and the U.S., they're home to much of the world's drug companies and invested big in vaccines. And that was before any of us knew whether these vaccines would work. So remember things like Operation Warp Speed, that program?
Yeah, sure do.
Well, so here's what happened.
Wealthy countries that controlled manufacturing invested in it. They took a risk, but it paid off. And they got first dibs on everything that came off their production lines.
And so Taylor says that supplies, especially at the beginning, it was limited. So other countries waited, even ones that could pay, like Canada and Australia. She says now, though, we're at a turning point. We are seeing a shift. Countries like the U.S. have the doses they need, and vaccine developers are now filling these other contracts.
They get to choose which country they deliver to first.
So where are the vaccine doses going?
Well, what it's looking like is to countries that can pay the most for the shots. There's an incentive. This is the system of vaccine development, drug development that we operate in. And this week we learned that Moderna and Pfizer are charging Europe even higher prices for booster shots. It's all happening as companies are also reporting record earnings, billions in profits. And critics of this whole dynamic really worry that it means that lower income countries are going to be waiting even longer and that others are going to be totally overcharged. And so they just say this whole system is broken and it doesn't work in a pandemic because you have a variant that's spreading like wildfire around the world. People are dying. There are shortages of oxygen and other supplies.
Right. But I mean, as you said, it's the system. Wasn't it the attraction of profits that drove the innovation?
There's definitely an argument for this. And I asked John LaMattina about this. He's a former Pfizer executive, led the global research and development efforts there for years. And he says it can be totally easy to forget and gloss over the fact that companies took a chance on all this, like Pfizer. The whole thing could have failed.
Pfizer took the risk of investing $2 billion just to see if you can get the vaccine up and running and made, did it in record time, and is basically saving the world.
Lower income countries aren't getting charged as much. But again, right now, the question is about the order. Who gets the doses first, second, and even third? And that's where the whole booster issue comes back in.
The World's Alana Gordon, thank you very much for breaking this down for us.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Officials in Mexico have long been frustrated by the flood of guns pouring into their country from the U.S., fueling violence south of the border. Now the Mexican government is suing. It just filed a case in federal court in Boston against some of the biggest gun makers in America. From Mexico City, the world's Jorge Valencia has more.
Mexican officials have been working on this lawsuit for 2 years. Foreign Relations Secretary Marcelo Ebrard says they have multiple objectives.
Primero, que las empresas demandadas compensen al gobierno de México.
Ebrard says the Mexican government wants compensation for what it argues is negligence on behalf of 11 gun manufacturers, importers, and distributors. He says the court would have to determine the amount in damages.
Pero el principal objetivo es lograr que las empresas dejen de hacer lo que están haciendo.
But the main objective, Ebrard says, is to get the companies to stop doing what they're doing. He says gun sellers and distributors know very well that tens of thousands of their firearms flow into Mexico.
It's a huge issue. It's kind of mind-boggling.
Yoan Grillo wrote a book about the cross-border weapons trade.
Blood, gun, money, how America arms gangs and cartels.
Grillo explains that since the beginning of the drug war, 160,000 firearms have been traced from Mexico back to the U.S. He says the cartels buy the same kind of weapons that the American military uses.
Barrett 50s fire 50 caliber bullets, they're bullets this size. They love those. That gives them this kind of firepower, so you know they can thump bullets through the armor of vehicles.
Grillo says AK-47s and AR-15s are also popular. So are Fabrique Nationale pistols, which they call cop killers because they can pierce bulletproof vests. Grillo says it's very easy to move them into Mexico.
Yeah, they buy all of that stuff in the U.S., yeah, including the Barrett 50s. Yeah, the Barrett 50s, you can buy them in Arizona without any special license. $15,000.
And once the buyer has the weapon, they just drive it straight through the border, Grillo says. But weapons also get leaked from the Mexican military or are smuggled from Central America. Agustin Barrios Gomez is with the Mexican Council on Foreign Relations. He says most of the blame belongs with Mexican officials.
Yes, American guns are being used to kill hundreds of thousands of Mexicans. That is true. And that needs to stop. And the U.S. needs to be serious about this. But at the end of the day, the narco trafficking problem is the direct responsibility of the Mexican federal government. Punto.
Barrios Gomez says Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is failing. Some 300,000 people have been killed in the drug war. 90,000 have simply gone missing. Barrios Gomez says he doesn't believe this week's lawsuit is part of a coherent government strategy.
This is a tool in order to strengthen Mexico's hand, sort of a bargaining chip or another flank in the war. They're opening another front in the war.
Many are skeptical the lawsuit will accomplish much. Mónica Serrano is a professor at the Colegio de México.
I don't think that there are major diplomatic consequences to be expected from the lawsuit.
Plus, Mexico faces an uphill battle in court. Since 2005, U.S. law shields gun manufacturers from crimes committed with their products.
I wish I could be more optimistic that if there is a positive result in terms of the lawsuit, I will be the first one to celebrate. I hope I'm proven wrong.
Gun manufacturers responded swiftly to the lawsuit. The National Firearm Industry Trade Association says it is the cartels that criminally misuse firearms illegally imported into Mexico. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Russia is banned from the Tokyo Olympics. You'll be forgiven if you didn't notice that. There are still some 330 Russian athletes at the Games, hauling in close to 60 medals. It's just that they're competing under the acronym ROC, the Russian Olympic Committee. That means no Russian flags and no national anthem when a Russian wins gold. Instead, they're saluted by this. Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1. The International Olympic Committee had hoped these punishments would teach the Russians a lesson, but as the World's Sarah Birnbaum reports, that's not quite what's happening.
In 2014, at the Sochi Olympics, the Russians devised an elaborate system of doping that involved secret rooms, special agents, and steroids dissolved in Chivas Royal whiskey. The guy who ran the drug testing lab at Sochi, Grigory Rodchenkov, spelled it all out in the documentary Icarus.
Does Russia have a systematic statewide doping system in place to cheat the Olympics?
Yes.
Were you the mastermind of a statewide system that cheated the Olympics?
Of course. Yes.
The Russians were caught red-handed, and the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, came up with this ban, not a ban, as a punishment. Travis Tigert, the CEO at the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, says it's a farce.
And I think it emboldens others who may be tempted to get away with the kind of fraud that Russia did, because it really provides no meaningful consequence to the greatest fraudulent scheme of doping that the world has ever seen.
The IOC could have done a blanket ban of the Russian team, but said it didn't want to punish innocent athletes just because of where they're from. Rob Keeler, who's an advocate for athletes in Montreal, says there's another reason.
Russia yields a lot of influence in the international sport. They have long tentacles and are sitting in a lot of international federations, and they put a lot of money into sport. So in a simple word, it all boils down to who's paying the bills and who's giving the money.
So Russian athletes are competing in Tokyo, but under a cloud of suspicion. Last week, American swimmer Ryan Murphy lost the 200-meter backstroke final to Russian Yevgeny Rylov. Murphy made some veiled accusations at a press conference afterwards.
At the end of the day, like I do believe there's doping in swimming, and that is what it is.
The Russian winner insisted he was clean and left it at that. But the Russian Olympic Committee had a field day with the comments. It wrote a tweet that was classic.
Как же нервирует наша победа отдельных коллег по цеху?
Slava Malamud, a Russian sports writer, gave me a rough translation.
Our victories get some of our colleagues nervous. Yes, we're here at the Olympic Games, whether someone likes it or not.
And there's a second part of the tweet.
We will forgive those who are weaker. God is their judge, and God is our helper. Oh my God, this is...
Malamud says the ROC's tweet encapsulates everything you need to know about how the ban is going down in Russia.
This is the entire attitude. It's not, oh my goodness, our athletes are being victimized because of our own mistakes. We need to rethink how we approach sports. It's Russia is still the best in spite of everything. And the evil West is trying to punish us for being so great, but we're still great.
This attitude is coming from the top. Last week, a spokesperson for the Russian Foreign Ministry posted a video on Instagram where she pretends to answer questions from the press.
Добрый день, уважаемые коллеги. Давайте начнем с вопросов, пожалуйста.
A fake reporter asks, "How do you feel about the Russian national anthem being replaced by Tchaikovsky?" And she says, "Oh, we love our rivals on the podium, so we want them to listen to classical music." The video ends with a hat tip to the band Queen.
We will rock you.
The hashtag "We will rock you" with rock spelled ROC for Russian Olympic Committee is trending on social media. Journalist Slava Malamud says the so-called ban is turning into a PR coup for the Russian state.
When it all comes down to it, they're competing, they're winning, they have an opportunity to tweet snarky replies to Americans. And they also get to be both proud and offended at the same time, which is the best possible position to be for them.
And they get to hear Tchaikovsky to boot. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Each week we bring you a story about tackling the climate crisis. This week on The Big Fix, planning for extreme heat.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Southeastern Europe is experiencing one of its worst heat waves in decades. On top of the extreme heat, fires are raging across the Mediterranean in Italy, Croatia, Albania, and Turkey. In Greece, fire crews are battling dozens of blazes, including in the suburbs of Athens. This is all happening just as the city of Athens has appointed a chief heat officer, making it only the second city in the world after Miami to have that post. The World's Lydia Manolidou spoke with Athens' heat officer under a smoky sky in the Greek capital. We'll hear that in a few minutes. First, though, Lydia joins me from Athens. What are things like there today, Lydia?
Well, Marco, if my voice sounds a little raspy, it is because of how things are here today. Right now, I'm in Athens, and I'm looking out my window and seeing smoke fill up the sky. I can smell it, too. There's a fire just a few miles north of Athens that's sparked up again, and we're seeing this happen all over the country. These blazes are starting in forests, which are dried out because of the heat, and then spreading to residential areas where people are losing their homes and businesses. Excuse me. And this is partly triggered by the heat wave we're in. Temperatures topped 115 degrees this week, Marco, which is the hottest on record in Greece.
Whoa, 115 degrees. I mean, that is harsh and it's dangerous. How are people dealing with those kinds of temperatures?
Well, Greek authorities have urged people to stay inside, try not to work, but of course that's not possible for many people. Earlier this week, I went to a local farmer's market, and it was 110 degrees that morning. I talked with Dimitra Manoli as she was checking out a customer at her vegetable stand. She told me fewer people are coming because of the heat, and that these temperatures are also affecting what she can grow and sell.
Not surprising to hear the heat directly impacts this farmer's bottom line. There's also tourism. I know Greece relies heavily on tourism, especially in the summer. What are the concerns about extreme heat impacting tourism?
There are concerns, and we're already seeing the impact. Just as an example, the Acropolis is on a reduced schedule this week because of the heat, which, by the way, is expected to get worse. There are projections that temperatures in Greece will rise by as much as nearly 7 degrees Fahrenheit by 2050. And I wanted to talk to some tourists, so I went to Monastiraki Square near the Acropolis. I saw that restaurants have set up misting fans. People were dunking their heads under water fountains. And what I heard from people isn't exactly an advertisement for Greek tourism.
It's very hot today.
We saw the forecasts, but we weren't prepared for the heat. We've never experienced this sort of heat before.
That's a big problem because you can't do anything outside. You have to be inside with the AC.
It's a turnoff. It feels like very unbearable to live here. We don't want to stay here.
That was Svetlana Prihotka from Ukraine, Ben Kehoe from Luxembourg, Alexander Charalambidis from Cyprus, and Sen Nielsen from Denmark.
So those out-of-towners are trying to deal with the heat this week. Meanwhile, Athens has a new chief heat officer, as I said, whose job it is to help the city prepare for rising temperatures in the long term. Lydia, you spoke with her during just her second week on the job.
That's right. Her name is Eleni Mirivili. She's worked with the Athens government on climate adaptation in the past, and now she's been hired as the city's chief heat officer as part of this global initiative that's coordinated by the Adrian Arsht Rockefeller Foundation. Mirivili was adamant that we should not meet during the hot hours of the day, so we met in the evening on a rooftop cafe in Athens with a cloud of wildfire smoke hanging above us.
The whole feeling is very ominous and very dark and oppressive.
Mirivili is coming into this role as experts warn that heat waves are going to become more frequent and longer. I wanted to know about her plan to deal with all of this. So here's part of my conversation with Eleni Mirivili. You're the first chief heat officer to have been appointed in Athens and in Europe. What does it mean to be a chief heat officer?
It means that I have to wake up every morning and worry about making the city more livable and making the vulnerable populations more safe in relation to rising heat and heat waves. I think one of the main things that I have to do is to make sure that there is more nature brought into the city, green and blue and generally natural solutions in the city. The second thing is the short term, being prepared and making sure that we can protect the most vulnerable. And the third thing is raising awareness about the severity of heat waves and how dangerous they are. And that of all the weather phenomena, this is the most deadly one.
Yeah, and I want to hear more about some of the solutions that you're thinking about. But first, I mean, you're dealing with this problem, which is that Athens is one of the hottest cities in mainland Europe. What makes Athens so hot?
Yes, Athens is definitely the hottest capital because it's very densely built with not so much green at all. And it has a lot of non-permeable surfaces that are dark, like asphalt and cement and a lot of buildings that are built close to each other. So they tend to trap heat and they have a high urban heat island effect, which means that it kind of traps heat and it radiates heat in the night, so it never really cools down.
Yeah, and I mean, we're at the rooftop of a cafe and looking out. There's some green, but there's not too much. If you walk around the city, it's, as you said, cement, concrete.
This is a particularly green part of the city because we're near the hill of the Acropolis. But if we look to the west of here, there's much, much less green. Low-income neighborhoods of the cities are usually the same neighborhoods that have the smallest percentage of green.
What are some other things, solutions that you're thinking about? I don't know if you're looking at what other cities are doing or have done.
Yeah, of course. Milan is doing extraordinary work with urban gardening and urban farming, as well as creating pedestrian walks with a lot of thick green and trees and canopy. Los Angeles has done putting a white sealer on the gray asphalt to lower temperatures. Phoenix has copied that. So a lot of cities are trying to do things in relation to heat.
Now, as for Athens, Mirivili says there are populations that are particularly vulnerable to heat waves, like the elderly and people who are homeless, also people who live in refugee camps, in tents and containers. Mirivili said she wants her work as Athens' chief heat officer to focus on people like them.
There should be a general mobilization, which I don't see, and we have to set these things in motion.
I mean, you know, we're sitting here and
ash keeps falling.
I mean, I see it. You have white chunks of ash in your hair. It's in our drinks. My microphone is full of it. I think I got some in my mouth.
This is so dramatic that you're wearing a black shirt that's covered with white pieces of ash from the forest fires surrounding us. I mean, it's very ominous. It just feels that this might be a prequel to what the future of this city might be like. It makes me worry about my city and its livability. I'm afraid that if we don't move now, it's going to be too late. I think this is the last time that we can change how to design the city and how to live in this city. And I feel a weight on my shoulders because now I have at least partially the responsibility to move things along and to help change this. And it's a big responsibility.
Yeah, clearly a big job. That was Athens' newly appointed chief heat officer, Eleni Mirivili, speaking with the world's Lydia Manolidou. Lydia, thank you very much. Stay safe and cool.
Thanks, Marco.
You can see just how extreme that heat is that's impacting Greece. We have photos at theworld.org. You're listening to The World. Being gay in the West African nation of Ghana has never been easy. Same-sex marriage is illegal, and now a new proposal could put LGBTQ people behind bars for a decade.
The bill is seeking to criminalize people for holding hands.
And the Epic of Gilgamesh heading home to Iraq. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Tokyo Olympics are wrapping up in the next few days. We've seen some incredible athletic achievements, but let's also remember the lead-up to these Olympics and a lot of controversy. I'm not just talking about holding the games during a pandemic. In the months before the Olympics, a few of the top organizers had to resign for sexist remarks, like Tokyo Olympic chief Yoshiri Mori, who disliked the idea of adding more women to the board.
He said that if they increase the number of female board members, the board meetings would never end because female members tend to speak more.
A sharp change from now. Tokyo 2020 is being touted as the first ever gender-balanced Olympic Games. 49% of the athletes in Tokyo are women, the largest percentage ever. Still, analysts say there's a lot of work to be done to eliminate gender bias. The World's Bianca Hillier has been in touch with Naoko Imoto, the advisor on gender equality to the Tokyo Olympics. Bianca, what's Imoto's background and what's the purpose of that role?
Imoto is a former Olympian herself and represented Japan as a swimmer at the 1996 Games. And since then, she's been working in international aid, mostly with UNICEF in Greece. But this February, when Tokyo Olympics chief Yoshiri Mori was booted for those remarks we just heard, organizers asked her to come on board as an advisor. And in this role, she's been looking at the differences in how male and female athletes are portrayed in Japanese media. So I spoke with Imoto about her game plan coming into this role in an interview this week. She's in Tokyo now for the Olympics.
Right, so that's her backstory. Let's hear your conversation with Naoko Imoto.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. When you did join the team, what exactly was the mandate for this role?
Well, to be honest, it wasn't very clear. And I think that even the organizing committee, gender team, didn't expect me to be too active because they were too busy and then they had only 4 or 5 months. And after I joined, I really thought about what we could do. And one thing was to do a lot of promotion, media promotion about gender. And I'm just very happy that this issue has really been brought up in media. This means that we were all thinking that it was not okay, but it was never really a time to point it out. So it's just the tip of an iceberg.
And then for this past week and a half during the Olympics, what have your days been like? I mean, are you monitoring Japanese media, trying to look at how these things are playing out?
Yes, I am watching different channels and see if they are portraying gender equally. And I do believe that this year, compared to other Olympics, it's pretty fair. But the problem is really outside the Olympics. You don't see a lot of female sports. And when it comes to Japan, they're often seen as beautiful, sexy, or cute, or what they eat, or who they date, or, you know, if they're mothers. And there's a lot of gender bias. It's not okay. You know, we're in 2021, and we just have to say, you know, things are not right.
You've been in the spot of being the athlete, possibly at times on the receiving end of these comments. Can you tell me a bit about what kind of impact these comments and this coverage could have on an athlete?
I think that, first of all, what is most important is that we are seeing equality with male athletes. And male athletes are portrayed as strong and powerful, and it's very easy to have positive images. But when the female athletes are portrayed in a sexualized way, this really brings gaps in our minds, and it just reproduces the stereotypes of women. They're very powerful. They can be really good role models. And in the case of Japan, the performance level is not very well portrayed, and then that has an impact on the future of the sport.
So at the end of the Olympics, will you come up with the list of conclusions or notes? And if so, who's responsible for making sure that gets put into practice in coverage in the future?
For sure. We will have a report in collaboration with the IOC and see how our experiences and then the coverage that we induced during the Games will bring changes. We will continue working with the National Olympic Committees, especially in Japan, in this matter. I will make sure that there will be discussions right after this. When it comes to Japan, I'm always going to be there and watching.
That's Naoko Imoto, the advisor on gender equality to the Tokyo Olympics, speaking with my colleague, the world's Bianca Hillier. A quick warning before this next story, we will be talking about violence against a child. Please take care while listening. In India, anger is growing after the suspected rape and murder of a girl. She's from the lowest and most oppressed caste in Hinduism. Here's what we know happened. Last Sunday, the 9-year-old, who has not been named, went to fetch water at a nearby crematorium, the family source for reliable fresh water. When the girl did not return home, her mother went out to look for her. The Hindu priest at the crematorium said her daughter had been electrocuted. He then convinced the mother to let them cremate the body and not call the police. People living near the crematorium suspected foul play and intervened.
So villagers put water on the pyre and they removed the half-burned body of the child, and then they called the police. The police had booked these criminals on the charges of negligence and also destroying the evidence. Not more than that.
That's Yogita Bayana, founder of the group People Against Rapes in India. Bayana suspected that the death of a girl from the Dalit community, also known as Untouchables, would not be thoroughly investigated and her killers would not be prosecuted.
When I went, I think I went to the spot and I reported it. However, I'm an activist, but I had to report because no media was giving any attention to this case. So I was the first one to make a video myself, going to the spot, going to the places, talking to the people, talking to the neighbors, talking to the mother. So whatever I have gathered and compiled, I only collected from the what I was hearing from the people, those who were presented there at that time.
What you found, Yogita, does it scan with what the police are finding in their investigation?
When we created this UN cry, next day they confirmed, and this is from their side, they had booked these criminals on sexual violence, also murder, everything, only after the pressure. So you see the difference, how they changed within 24 hours of creating the pressure, the mass movement.
I pointed out earlier that the Dalit community in India in the caste system is at the lowest of that economic ladder. Why have they been so historically oppressed or targeted in India?
The caste system does exist in India. It is the reality of our social fabric. One cannot deny that. But by and large, let me tell you one more thing. I worked almost with 100 children. Irrespective of their caste, religion, they are abused. Every third child is abused in our country. And so many rape cases happen to all across the community. It is, at least when I talk about children, it has nothing to do with community. Yes, Dalit women are suppressed. They are more sexually exploited. But in this case, because they are also economically very weak. So I differentiate these two things, like have and have nots.
Yogita, let's get back to this case. Tell me more about the anger around this killing of this 9-year-old girl. What is the community saying?
We are outraged, but what we want is we want justice and we want those police officers to be suspended, terminated forever and booked for delaying and for supporting the criminals, because rather than supporting the victim's family, they were supporting the criminals. They are to be accountable. They detained the parents of the girl for 14 hours in the police station. They did not let them go and tried to manipulate, tried to brainwash them not to report unnecessarily things which can create work pressure for police or can de-repute them.
So that was problematic. The police did arrest 4 people in connection with this case. Does that spell a changing attitude in India toward these kinds of episodes?
They've done it in our country. 4 years ago, we got a new law where if you rape and brutalize a girl who's, below 12, there is a provision for capital punishment. So avoiding all these hassles, avoiding all this reputation, I think the police wanted to make it look like an electrocution kind of a accident and not as a brutality and a murder.
Yogita, without strong forensic evidence in this case, do you expect justice?
No. Any which ways, I don't expect justice in any case, because justice delayed is justice denied. So many cases I have been dealing for last 14 years, none of them have gone to logical conclusion till now. They all are in the court.
So one Dalit activist was quoted saying there's rape apathy in India, especially when it occurs to Dalits. What needs to be done, Yogita, to combat both the rape apathy as well as just the sheer number of rapes occurring in India generally?
So apathy is not good enough. We want it to stop. We can't afford to lose more daughters. So we have to work on the gender sensitization. We have to teach our boys, not our girls. We always address the wrong audience. We tell our girls to wear sober clothes or don't go out in the night to protect themselves. But we don't talk to our boys. So it's not a magic wand which can just give you a quick solution. We have to combat it from, hammer it from all the corners. And it cannot be done by one person. It has to be done by the whole community, from the political leaders' wish, willpower. Otherwise, nothing will change.
Yogita Bayana is an Indian anti-rape activist. She's a founder of the People's Against Rapes in India movement. She joined us from Delhi. Yogita, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, tens of thousands of ancient artifacts and pieces of art have been looted and smuggled out of the country. This week, the U.S. agreed to return more than 17,000 treasures to Iraq, including an ancient clay tablet containing a portion of the Epic of Gilgamesh. Nada Shabut is a professor of art history and coordinator of the Contemporary Arab and Muslim Cultural Studies Initiative at the University of North Texas. First of all, Nada, how did these pieces get to the U.S. in the first place? Where have they been?
Since 2003 and all the looting that had happened, many of which was very organized and people knew exactly what they were taking out, it sort of was smuggled through the region, through the UAE, through Jordan at times, and found its way to where it wanted to be.
What was your reaction when you heard the U.S. will be returning these artifacts and this art to Iraq?
To be honest, it was a refreshing piece of news. Returning them is great, but also this is just a little drop in a bucket full of water. So this is a good step, but neither resolves the problem of all the looted works, nor does it really actually establish a system for stopping or returning.
So if it's a drop in the bucket, let's pull back. What has the U.S. war in Iraq done to the country's cultural heritage? And is it just the 2003 invasion and occupation, or do we have to go back to Operation Desert Storm in 1991 to understand the full impact of the looting?
Absolutely. We saw images of looting on TV. We saw the museum, and the late Donnie George was the director of the museum, pleading with military to help protect the Museum of Modern Art, and other many other museums in Iraq did not even fare any attention from anyone, no protection. So, for example, the Museum of Modern Art, there was a fire and it was practically all destroyed. And then there was large looting and destruction, but, you know, a lot of the major works by the major Iraqi artists found their way out. I have seen looted works in New York. I've seen looted works in Amman, in Beirut, and many people actually will show me. Many Iraqis at the time who were able to buy some of those works did, with the intention that they will return it to the country when there is a stable government. Well, of course, that never happened. And now, who knows where these works are?
Have you ever brought this up with the directors of museums when you see these artifacts?
Yes. And in fact, even one time I wrote to Interpol, who were very appreciative of the information, because I know of two works that were being sold in the black market in Amman. And their response was that, you know, we appreciate your word, but we really need an official intervention. We need the Iraqi government to acknowledge that these works are looted.
So these 17,000 artifacts and treasures will return to Iraq. But you've written, Nada, that looting and smuggling continues in Iraq. Explain what's going on.
Yes, as a matter of fact, looting does continue, and the state of the cultural heritage is not any better than it was in 2003. I'm writing the same things that I wrote in 2003. I am making the same pleas of 2003. The archaeological sites are not really well protected. The looting continues. Much of the lost artifacts are not returned. There's no money for restoration. There have been no interest in helping the Museum of Modern Art pick up where it is. What I tried to do with the Modern Art Iraq Archive website, which was about documenting, was to try to trace. And no one knows or no one wants to say, where are the works? What were the works? Only the artists who were alive were identifying their own works. And so there's no sort of organized effort to identify, archive, document, as well as then, you know, try to find these works. And by not returning or by not even knowing what was looted, the country is deprived of its history. The Iraqi people need to know their whole history, Mesopotamian, the Islamic, and the modern. You know, this is a living culture. You know, in Iraq, if you go to Iraq, you'll be treated to a famous way of cooking fish, masgouf fish. That's actually how Iraqis cooked it, with the same recipes since, you know, the Mesopotamian times.
Wow. So, Professor, I mean, to that point, you're from Baghdad. Your career is devoted to art and Iraq's own rich history. Tell us a bit more about what Iraqis have been deprived of in recent years. Like, what is the one thing that the Iraq Museum has sadly been missing that, you know, Iraqis should have seen?
So, you know, since the protests that were started in 2019, when we see on TV the protesters and their art represented as the contemporary Iraqi art, which is graffiti and reactionary and protest art, which is great. But that's by no means contemporary Iraqi art. That actually denies the heritage of their modernism. If those artists themselves are not able to see the heritage in the museum, then they don't really know how they got to where they are now. And what they're doing and what they're learning, they think it's all new. The sad thing about it is that those artists would have been able to pick up where the modernists and the other Iraqi artists, because Iraqi art in the region was quite progressive and recognizable. And in fact, you know, many of the artists of the Arab world studied in the academy in Baghdad. So this is the heritage that Iraqis are deprived of. How will they know how to move forward if they don't know what was their past?
So what do you think needs to be done to help restore and better protect Iraq's cultural heritage? And are Iraqi officials active in making this happen?
Some Iraqi officials are. I think things are improving to some point. The problem is they may be overwhelmed with what they have to be doing. But I know that they have not really put enough resources in documentation and archiving, let alone finding. But there need to be a more coordinated effort worldwide. At this moment, it's us academics, scholars, archaeologists, historians who are doing these efforts.
Nada Shaboud is a professor of art history and coordinator of the Contemporary Arab and Muslim Cultural Studies Initiative at the University of North Texas. Nada, great to meet you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Marco.
In West Africa, a victory for LGBTQ communities in Ghana today. They're celebrating after a judge dropped charges against 21 people detained since March for unlawful assembly. They had been arrested at a human rights training workshop. The legal victory comes just as a controversial new bill targeting LGBTQ people is making its way through Ghana's legislature. Same-sex relations in the predominantly Christian nation are already illegal. Being gay in Ghana can cost people access to health care. Now, this proposed legislation would further criminalize LGBTQ people, even people who advocate on their behalf. Reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman has our story from Ghana's capital, Accra.
24-year-old Suhaida Tudramani is seeking refuge in an undisclosed location in Ghana's capital, Accra, after receiving several death threats. She is transgender and has faced incessant harassment, blackmail, and violent attacks.
I am living in a society where people are ready to kill you because you say that you are LGBT. Just in my neighborhood, a friend was beaten by a soldier because the soldier said he did not know whether they were a male or female.
The 24-year-old constantly glances over her shoulders as she talks to me. Now, she fears life will become a lot more miserable with a proposed legislation seeking to criminalize LGBTQ advocacy in the West African country, meaning organizing efforts to support sexual minorities, donating to such initiatives and sharing encouraging messages, either on mainstream or social media, could land one 10 years in jail.
The bill is seeking to criminalize people for holding hands. Point already, life in Ghana is so terrible if you are LGBT.
Some critics of the controversial bill say it is sponsored by the World Congress of Families, an American group that campaigns internationally against same-sex marriage. Abdulwadud Muhammad is communications director for the LGBT Rights Ghana.
We're all in this country when the anti-LGBT coalition hosted the World Congress of Families in Accra here. We know very, very well that they are behind this bill. And everything that is happening currently in Ghana here is the similar thing that happened in Uganda and Nigeria.
But the lawmakers championing the proposed legislation have denied this. Speaker of Ghana's Parliament, Alban Bagbin, who has described being LGBTQ as worse than COVID-19, indicated at a news conference that the bill will pass easily.
We cannot be threatened in our homes. This must be stated loud and clear to those who have come to do business in Ghana, those who represent their countries and think that they are right. They can never dictate to us. The Parliament of Ghana will pass this bill as soon as possible.
Human rights advocates in Ghana and across the African continent find the speaker's posturing extremely troubling. Robert Akoto Amwafo is former country director for Amnesty International. He wants President Akufo-Addo to intervene.
LGBT people do not harm anybody by their existence, and therefore it's important that we rather put laws that protect them as a vulnerable group of people. It's important that as a president, he stands for all people and not just a group of people.
Same-sex relations are banned in more than half of all the countries in Africa. But even in countries with friendly laws, the reality on the ground only portends danger for LGBTQ people. There are many reasons for this hostility in Africa, but analysts say that among the top factors are colonial laws, religious morality, and the idea that LGBTQ identity is imported from the West. In 2019, parents and Christian groups in Ghana protested against the introduction of comprehensive sexuality education for primary school children. They contended the plan was demonic, aimed at spreading LGBTQ acceptance in Africa. During that same year, an Afrobarometer survey revealed that only 7% of the entire Ghanaian population is tolerant of the LGBTQ community. However, news of the draft legislation has triggered resentment from many ordinary Ghanaians like JJ Ikuyamwa.
It disappoints me that the affirmative action bill, the spousal bill, these are all bills sitting on the shelves of parliament collecting dust, but this bill is being forced through or is.
Godimens feels it violates people's rights.
I think it's absolutely ridiculous to legislate on how two consenting adults have sex. You cannot make a law that bans the public discussion of a certain topic.
While many are worried that the bill, when passed, will not bode well for the country's tourism industry, proponents have discounted this, citing countries like Saudi Arabia. Human rights groups say the bill, if given the nod, could become one of the most draconian pieces of anti-LGBT legislation anywhere in the world. In that case, Robert Akotuamwafo hopes it will be contested.
We can litigate at the Supreme Court and ask for the constitutionality of this law.
Despite the current tension and the enormous threats on their lives, many queer Ghanaians say they remain relentless in organizing and pushing for a better tomorrow, one that embraces diversity in any shape or form. In the meantime, though, the popular and controversial musician Sister Derby has dropped a new song in solidarity with queer Ghanaians.
Why do you want to hate somebody when you do you any bad?
The song depicts that gays and lesbians are in everyone's home, hence they deserve love.
It's nice to be nice, but you drive up with the LGBTQ. You're
for the world. I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
LGBTQ. Your doctor could be LGBTQ. Your teacher could be LGBTQ. Your basic could be LGBTQ.
Yemi Alade from Nigeria is a superstar in West Africa. She made a connection across the Atlantic with Bomba Estéreo, the innovative Colombian trio. Together, they combine Nigerian and Colombian idioms for a new recording. The single is just out, appropriately titled
Conexión Total.
Total Connection. It's a mutual appreciation society between Bomba Estéreo and Yemi Alade. Bomba Estéreo's founder, Simon Mejia, says their music has always been inspired by Africa. For Yemi's part, she thinks collaborations between Africa and Latin America are too few, almost non-existent. Considering Bomba Estéreo was planning on calling it quits a few years ago, let's call this collaboration with Yemi Alade a renaissance for the band. From Bomba Estéreo and Yemi Alade. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.